The topic of our forum tonight is aquaculture. The title suggested that this has to do with growing fish in your own backyard, and that's a bit misleading. Aquaculture deals with much more than simply fish. It has to do with aquatic systems and their ability to produce food, and our forum will take a look at that. We're fortunate in having a person with some expertise on the staff who can tell us about that and tell about her experiences studying it and about some of the experiments which are now begun here at Holden, or which have been attempted in the past or will be attempted in the future. Our expert is Meredith Olson, whom many of you know. Meredith tells me that she studied aquaculture for a couple of years at the University of Puerto Rico, came to Holden Village, initiated the aquaculture project, which has resulted in the wading pool part of the River Sauna now, and perhaps she can tell in the course of this evening how the transition took place. Spent some time last year, from about the 1st of November until May, studying at an institute called the New Alchemy Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. There she studied aquaculture, although the New Alchemy Institute is interested in all forms of ecologically
oriented
or sensitive or informed agricultural forms. And she's going to begin, I guess, with some slides taken while she was at the New Alchemy Institute, showing some of the operations of aquaculture and telling us a bit about it. After she's shown the slides, we'll just open up for a general discussion about any of the themes that she's raised. Therefore, I would suggest that during the showing of the slides, limit your questions to questions which refer specifically to what's being shown, a clarification or something like that. But let's not begin a general discussion during the slide presentation. Let's wait until after the slides are over, and then we'll try to have a general discussion dealing with the possibilities of aquaculture. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, so
you're
on stage.
Thank you. I would like to begin by thanking the people of the Holden community and especially the Science Committee for all the support and encouragement that I got while working with the Fish Project here last year, as well as allowing me this opportunity of going to work with the New Alchemy Institute, which was a really fantastic way to spend this last winter. And so, hearty thanks to all
the Science,
of you people.
The Science Committee sponsored her time at the New Alchemy Institute. And
I thought before I get into the slides, I might begin with a little introduction about New Alchemy, discuss just a few of the ideas that are central to what the Institute is working on, talk about some of the areas of research that they're working in, and then get into the slides, and then hopefully open up for discussion and people can talk about areas that things that they've seen that relate to things that the new alchemists are working on. I don't claim to be an expert by any means in any of these fields. I have had some experience with aquaculture, and I'm just beginning to learn about agriculture, energy sources, so I'm sure a lot of you can contribute a lot more to the discussion than I will be able to in these fields, but maybe the slides will give us some place to start. The New Alchemy Institute is a small nonprofit research institute that, as Harold says, working in the fields of ecologically derived agriculture, aquaculture, energy production, and architecture. There are presently centers in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, where I was working this last year, in Prince Edward Island in Canada, and in Costa Rica. I was founded about 8 years ago by John Todd and Bill McLarney, who are both scientists that were working at both teaching at universities and working with some large laboratories. Woods Hole is a big center for oceanographic and freshwater research, and they were involved with the large institutions out there. I think they became somewhat disillusioned with so-called progress of modern science and technology. Both of them were working in the field of ichthyology, study of fish, but they found, I think, that their vision became so narrow by the small area that they were called to be specialists in, that it was to the exclusion of a lot of other things that they thought would be important. And so John Todd, in beginning the Institute, has written a small paper called A Modest Proposal, in which he talks about some of the principles that the Institute is founded on. One of these things is, what he discusses mainly, is the loss of diversity in the world in energy, in agriculture, and as well as in the society as a whole, resulting from these different practices. He talks about in our society, as we're called to specialize more and more in specific fields, people become more and more dependent on specialists and on machines to do tasks that in the past everyone has been able to do for themselves. We're becoming more and more removed from production of our own energy, of our food, our shelters, our clothing, and these tasks have been given over to machines and to specialists. And as we allow this to occur more and more, we really remove ourselves from the vital life forces that really allow the creativity to flow and really keep us in contact with the earth. And so Dr. Todd's thesis is that this trend can be reversed. It's not going to come about by starting at the top, passing laws, but it's going to come about by individuals, small groups, beginning in the area in which they live and starting in small ways to begin to produce a little bit of their own energy, grow some of their own food, fish, plants, whatever, utilize the wastes that are produced in these different systems, and base these different techniques that they're using on practices that are ecologically sound, as well as economically sound, hopefully. And so that has been the purpose of the New Alchemy Institute, to try to address these questions, develop the skills and the tools that are necessary for people without a lot of technological high levels of training to be able to become involved in some of these things. Okay, I think I could probably, maybe I'll save the slides a little bit more, because I have a little bit to say about agriculture, and then I'll get into what New Alchemy is doing. I tried to divide these up into different areas: agriculture, aquaculture, energy. But it's very difficult, because I think one of the most important things about the New Alchemy Institute is that all these things are seen as they have to be integrated together in everything that they do. And so when I tried to talk about one thing, I found myself bringing in all these other things. You'll see when I begin the slides that you can't just talk about one aspect without involving everything else. So, but I will try and divide things up a little bit. First of all, I thought I'd go a little bit over the agriculture, which is an area that I'm just beginning to learn about. People at New Alchemy recognized a trend in modern agriculture, aquaculture as well, it's the same thing, towards large-scale commercial production. And this is often the production of only one variety or one species. And this takes over, in a certain area, acres and acres and acres. And this is, as a matter of fact, the term agribusiness has replaced the word agriculture in a lot of places. It's a large business. This being a big business requires a lot of money, a lot of machinery, and the heavy use of chemical fertilizers and herbicides, pesticides. And, of course, the production of some crops has been increased immensely. It's been called the Green Revolution. We're going to save the world by all this high production. But some of the things that we have to look at are, what are the consequences of these practices? Is this type of production really viable? Is it worth it? Is it sustainable? I really don't think that I need to cover a couple of facts related to the widespread use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides. We all know that chemical fertilizers are derived primarily from fossil fuels, and that's a field that is well covered, dwindling supplies. Another area that's had widespread coverage in the news is the amount of toxicants that are building up in, say, fish tissues in different lakes. Pregnant women aren't supposed to eat trout or salmon from Lake Erie, something like that, because of the levels of PCBs, DDT, whatever that has come through erosion into the water and is concentrated in these different fish species and to the real deterioration of the whole ecology. What I would like to talk a little bit about are what happens to the soil conditions when the production of food is based primarily on these practices. A lot of the chemicals that are used are not specific for one organism. They don't only hit the insect that's destroying the crops. They destroy a wide variety of organisms in the soil. And thus they destroy the soil's natural mechanism of recycling the nutrients. The bacteria break down organic material, earthworms do the same thing, and the soil is much richer for it. And when you've destroyed these, then you become more heavily dependent in the future on the chemical fertilizers, less healthy soil condition, less healthy plants, need more herbicides, pesticides. It's a vicious cycle that you get involved in. Another aspect of the Green Revolution is the development of hybrid species that are high producers, but people aren't only looking at production, but they're also looking at storage and shipment of these different products. Apples, for example, all of Washington, I think, well, a lot of Washington is covered with orchards of red delicious apples. And that name, I think, is a misnomer. Anyone can say that they know a lot of other apples that taste much better, but they won't last. And you can't buy Red Delicious. You can't buy all these other varieties in your supermarkets in the middle of the summer or whenever you want. But who cares? If people could become used to eating what's around when the season is right, and we don't have to have one area of the country totally monoculture of one species to supply the whole rest of the country. It's a very energy intensive means of production, because one area culturing for the whole country then implies there's no natural resistance, because the whole area is one crop. And so if a disease comes in, you have to have heavy levels of chemicals to keep away the pests. Tom Prohl told me down at 25 Mile there's birds dropping right and left all over in the orchards. They're just spraying all the time, and it's killing a lot more than just the pests that would attack the apples. Then you have large facilities for storage. And then you have to ship these things all the way across the country. It's an energy-intensive process that really, perhaps if we change some of our ideas about what to eat when, might not need to be. Another offshoot of this type of production is that we're losing some of the genetic variability. John Todd, this gets back to the loss of diversity that I talked about. This, particularly with agriculture, culturing fewer and fewer varieties, and what happens if say a pest comes in and starts to destroy? Like, take for example in the Midwest or probably a lot of other areas. I happen to be from Minneapolis. I know in about 10 years the place is going to be a desert, because the Dutch elm has been planted over the whole city, and they're dropping right and left. And if perhaps a more creative person had been in charge of the planting program, we had a lot of different trees, then we would have the natural defense mechanism that's in nature when you don't have just one species, but you have a lot of different things interacting, and if one goes, then another one comes in. But this doesn't happen when you have large-scale production of just one crop. So I think we'll get into the slides. I'll show a couple of the alternatives that the New Alchemists have been working on that They say, we're not answering the question, can we feed the world? But can we feed a small group of people? And what is the world made of but a lot of small groups of people? You know, it's not going to be production for the masses, but they say that people working, a lot of different people working in different areas, developing agriculture for that area, dependent on the climate, all these things can significantly contribute to the food production and reduction of energy needs of our country, of the world. And in an urban setting, that they're talking to people in an urban setting as well as in a rural setting. I say primarily an urban setting for the work that the New Alchemists are doing. So we can turn on the slides. This is just a shot of the Institute.
Want a flashlight?
Oh, I would like a flashlight to talk about the farming, since I'm still learning. This is from the road. It's an old New England farm. It's a really charming place. Okay. Just a couple shots around the farm. Nobody lives here. The buildings are just offices and working space for the people. Just a couple buildings we have there, and people. There are about 15 employees, full-time employees of the institute. Yeah. Okay. There's an apricot too. This is the backyard, and you can see some of the structures that I'll be talking about in a few minutes. The New Alchemists are dedicated, thank you, not only to to research but also to education. And so part of their program that they've been doing ever since they started was having what they call Farm Saturdays. At noon on Saturday they open up to the public, and people come. There's a brief introduction to what New Alchemy is about, and then for an hour there's a potluck lunch. And these go from May through October. And I was there just for the first couple, three in May, and there were 150 people already coming in May. And then all afternoon there are workshops, and the people that are working in the different areas sit down with whoever's interested and discuss the practice that they're using and talk about these different things. And it's really exciting. And everyone goes to everyone else's talks and learns, and it's great. Okay, next slide.
What's that bird there?
You tell me. Okay, these are the gardens. These are the intensive beds right here. A tenth of an acre, where there are experiments presently in progress to determine what are the best ways of trying to garden that use use readily available machinery. Actually, no fossil fuel, no fueled machinery has been used on this plot at all. And using organic fertilizers, maximum utilization of the sun's energy, and recycling of nutrients. Next slide. The technique that they're using involves the construction of what's called raised beds. And you can see that these are individual. There's 20 of these raised beds in the tenth of an acre. They're about 5 feet wide. And the way you build them is just actually the trenches dug between the different beds. And the trenches then, during the summer, you put the weeds into the trenches. As compost materials become available, put those into the trenches. And hopefully by the end of the summer, the trenches are level with the bed. And then the next year, you dig the trench right adjacent to that spot. And so within about 4 years, you've composted and renewed the soil in your whole garden.
Where do you crawl? Where do you reach?
So you work from the trenches. They're about 4 or 5 feet wide, and you can easily reach to the middle of the bed. And then you plant the entire bed. Next slide. Next slide, please. And the bed is not planted with only one crop. The techniques involve what's called companion planting, where you put in a number of different things that hopefully enhance the growth of the other, or at least do, keep the pests away. Like, okay, I have some raised beds down in Lucerne right now. I'm trying to do a little garden using these techniques. And just got some marigolds from up here, and I'm going to be putting those around the tomatoes because they're supposed to keep the aphids away. And again, when you have a variety of different things growing instead of all one type of thing, then of course it's harder for the pests to get from one plant to the next, and you're not going to lose a whole field of something, because you might lose a few, but likely it's not. Maybe the pest will just stay on a few isolated plants and not take over your whole garden.
What are those truncated trees?
Those are probably for some pole beans.
Is this area in Massachusetts?
This area, sand. It's about 2 inches of topsoil.
Yeah, I was going to say, the soil does not look particularly rich, but I was wondering about how dense is the pest population, the insect pest population?
Well, they had problems with bean beetles and cabbage worms. Quite a few. They had, a significant amount of problems with the pests. I don't know the exact. There are some articles in the journal that pertain specifically to integrated pest control. But I'm not sure. As I said, this is the area I didn't work at all in this. This is just what I got through osmosis, being there through the winter, when the gardens were covered in snow, and then just seeing the beginnings of the plantings. And I worked with fish all the time, so I'm just getting an introduction now at Lucerne, and it's exciting, but I can't say that I know a lot about it.
Are the plants, the vegetables planted very densely, very close together?
Yeah, they are. Mm-hmm. Sure, and then you plant, you try and plant, say, deep-rooted things next to shallow-rooted mm-hmm. things. So instead of having to have 2 feet between your rows, if you put your carrots next to some lettuce and next to something else with a deep root, you can plant a lot more closely than you mm-hmm. could if you just had one area again for one whole crop. Good. Okay. Composting, of course, is a very important part of any organic farming. And this is a compost area, taking out the stuff that's been making itself all over the winter. The leftover materials from the garden are brought here, and then neighbors bring in leaves. People with truckloads, instead of going to the dump, drop them off at New Alchemy. And we usually go and get a couple truckloads full of manure from the nearest horse farm, and in the fall make a big pile, and in the summer have got lots of good fertilizer. Okay.
How long does it take a compost pile to produce useful fertilizer?
Well, they have a speed method. It takes about 2 weeks. But that involves turning it every day and shredding the materials before they go in. And then there are, of course, anywhere up to, say, a year if you just depending on what you have available. Mm-hmm. Worms also are really good for breaking down things, making very good rich soil. And there is some worm production going on here.
But with the right recipe.
With the right recipe, you can.
And attention.
Yeah.
And so on, you can actually do it in 2 weeks.
Yeah, in summer, warm temperatures.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess this is. That's about all I was going to say about the gardens. I'm going to talk a little bit now about the energy. John Todd in the Modest Proposal talks about the loss of diversity in the energy sources that we're using in the modern world. People in the past had a variety of sources for their energy, windmills, and they used water power. And in their homes, they heated with wood or coal or peat or whatever. But with our increasing need for energy, with our increasing energy consumption these days, we've talked ourselves into believing that we can only sustain our energy needs if we totally turn to fossil fuels and nuclear power. Again, this is a much publicized area, and I don't want to dwell on this at all. There's no need to talk about all the air pollution there, the buildup of radioactive waste in the environment. I think that the New Alchemists, they're basically an anti-nuclear statement in what they do, but I think the strongest statement that they can make is the creation of some viable alternatives. And this is what was shown to me, and you don't get any kind of a negative emphasis when you go there. You just get that this is everything that can be done, and it's a very optimistic approach. It was really great to work with these people. The energy systems are hard to talk about at New Alchemy because they're so integrated in what else is going on. So I'm just going to get into talking about these different structures and talk about how the energy in the buildings is related to the function and the structure. Basically, the forms of energy that they're working in are the non-polluting renewable sources, solar power, wind energy. And again, these forms of energy don't really lend themselves to large-scale application, but rather to application by individuals, small groups of people, on a small scale. So it goes along with the other kind of work that they're doing. Okay, the buildings that they've started working in, they call bioshelters, which are structures with the purpose of year-round culturing of food in a temperate climate. I'd say the climate similar to maybe at Lucerne, maybe not as much snow as Holden Village, but anyway, in an area where they do, there's snow, and usually you wouldn't think about being able to keep any kind of a building without a lot of, say, commercial greenhouses are heavily dependent on electrical heat to keep them going in this time of year. The earliest structure that they built was this one, which is the dome. This has now turned out to be a three-season greenhouse aquaculture facility because there's not enough insulation to keep the heat in during the cold months. Let's see, I think I have a shot inside the building. This is just in the spring when we're starting to put some more plants in, and pretty soon would be stocking the fish. This pond is now being used as a breeding pond for tilapia, which is one of the most important species that work is being done with at New Alchemy. The tilapia is a fish that's very important around the world in aquaculture. It's native to Africa and the Middle East. One point that really interests me is that it's native to the Sea of Galilee and other lake seas in Israel, and was probably the fish that was used in the miracles with the loaves and the fishes and the other references to the fish in the New Testament. Because it's still a very important cultured fish in Israel, as well as being a native fish in a lot of the waters there. Unfortunately, I don't have a picture of a tilapia, but they look similar to a sunfish, a little darker coloration. They're very hardy fish, very important, as I said, in food production around the world, able to withstand conditions that hardly any other species could withstand. They're easy to spawn, disease resistant, just a real super fish to work with. So that's what's being cultured in this pond. Okay.
Is that plastic?
Fiberglass.
Kelvin. Is that clear? Or?
That was glass. Was the windowless glass. Next to the dome, there's a little windmill. I don't have, this is part of another system, but this is the only shot I have of it. So you can go on to the next slide. This is a sail wing windmill, which runs a small pump for the next system, the system which we'll show on the next slide, which is called the mini arc. This was one of the first of the arc designs. Initially, there were three ponds which were covered with this, I believe that also is a fiberglass cover, three covered buildings with ponds. There are three different levels, and there were different species of fish in the ponds, and one pond was used for production of fish food, zooplankton and phytoplankton and different microscopic animals and plants. And then the windmill next to it ran the pump, which pumped the water up to the top pond, and then gravity brought it down to the other ponds. Just an incidental thing, the little attachment on top of the pond, the upper pond, is a bug light, which we had for our fish project here at Holden last summer. probably worked a little bit better at New Alchemy than it did here because it got nice and cool in the evenings here, which we all enjoy, but it's not good for bugs. So there were just a couple of the weeks, the hottest part of the summer, July and August, that the fish really got a significant number of bugs, I think, from that light. But this is one of the areas of work, is working with alternative food sources for fish in commercial production rather than just the pelleted feeds. They're also working with some worm production, as I mentioned. Okay. This is a small structure, which is a prototype for the larger ARC, which you'll see in a minute. This incorporates vegetable production and then a small pond. I think the pond you can see better in the next slide. This pond had species of catfish in it all winter long. We were harvesting vegetables throughout the winter in this greenhouse. And this is the kind of thing that I think is really applicable for a family even to have in their backyard, or perhaps even attached to the house to provide some of the heat for the house. And then in the summer, perhaps whitewash the sides or something so that the house, of course, wouldn't overheat. But the water is a very good storage for heat, and the building worked really well. It's a nice little... it's a good little building. I don't know what to say.
Is it heated entirely by solar?
By solar heat. It didn't freeze this winter. The north side is a insulated wall, double insulation, and the south side is exposed to the sun. Since I don't have a shot from the outside, I'm not going to talk more about this, but I'll go on to the ARC, which is the next slide, which was a result of the initial little prototype. And this is the ARC. Solar heated greenhouse and fish production facility. The main parts of the energy. I'll talk about. Okay, the stairs going up here. That's the ground level in the back. So the building is bermed in on the north side. So there's a constant temperature throughout the year on that side. This is the south side. It is exposed, allowing the sun to penetrate. This is fiberglass with Kelwall fiberglass, 90% light transmittance, allows UV light to go through. So it looks like it doesn't allow much light, but it really does. It's a very good transmitter of light. So let's see, windmill. The windmill on the top powers an air compressor. It doesn't generate electricity, but powers an air compressor for a couple of the needs within the building. I think I can go to the next slide, perhaps. Okay, just another shot showing the what are called solar algae ponds outside the ARC and inside the ARC. There are a couple types of solar heating, one being passive solar heating, which just means that say you open your you have your shades open and the sun comes in and heats up the room. And that's how this building is primarily heated, just as I said, through the design of being bermed in on the north side and the south side being exposed. There is also an active system involved run by the air compressor where the warm air from the top of the building, maybe you could just go through the next few slides kind of quickly, just a few shots inside the building. This right on the left here is a big cement encased area with rocks inside. That warm air from the top of the building is shot through this rock storage unit and then comes out in the bottom of the building. During the middle of the afternoon, the compressor is running and it turns on the pump. The air goes through and the rocks heat up. Then during the middle of the night, the compressor comes on again. And the warm air that is stored in the rocks is passed out in the bottom of the building, and there's vents all along down here where the warm air comes out and keeps the temperature, keeps it warmer. So that's an active system that's involved. This was in the spring when there were really hardly any plants compared to what it was like all winter long. The temperate things that we grow in the summer, we were growing in here in the winter, and so now it's going to be for tropical plants and production of things that the season in Cape Cod isn't long enough for. They're going to try some sweet potatoes and a variety of things. There's also papaya tree, fig tree, banana. It's really incredible in there. And this little area over here is all tomato plants. We're constantly bombarded with questions, you know, well, is what, you know, how much money can you get out of this if you put so much in? And so this is an attempt at production of a commercially important crop, and to see what a small area, like foot for foot, how much poundage could be produced in what amount of time. Okay.
What happens if you don't have a sunny day?
Well, the plants just don't grow as well. But this, we had, well, I'm sure you all heard about the blizzards out in Massachusetts this last year, and the building didn't freeze all winter long. There was slowed down growth in January for a period of time, but the building got down to 38 degrees, I think, was the lowest it ever got.
The night temperature varied very much from the day temperature?
Yeah, well, nights would get down to 38 was the lowest, usually in the low 40s perhaps in the middle of winter, mm-hmm. and the daytime temperature would be in the 70s, and during the spring it got up into the 90s easily. And then you have, in the summer, you have to vent the building. The whole top of the building lifts up, and there are little holes in the side that open up and vents, and you have to vent it. So the work in...
Growing tomatoes all winter with nighttime temperatures of 40 degrees?
No, the tomatoes were planted in the spring.
Oh,
early spring.
When the temperature was, when you said 38 degrees inside, what would the temperature be outside?
Perhaps 8-10 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mary?
Yes?
Could this kind of building function in an area like Western Washington, Oregon? Where it rains majority of the year?
I don't know. They have. We had quite a bit of sunshine this last winter and got really good growth. But as far as Western Washington, I don't.
Okay, I just wondered.
I don't know. A couple shots. Okay, I'll talk about the. You can see the rock storage area right there. Now these back here, there's a battery of solar ponds. There are 9 ponds back there, and they're also very important in the heat collection and storage for the building. I'm sure you all know that water is a good collector and storer of heat. And these ponds got down to lowest temperature in them was like 51, 52 degrees all winter long. And so they were all night long giving off heat to the building. We had tilapia in here all winter long, which, as I said, they're a tropical species. We did, I will admit, 1 week during that blizzard, we did put aquarium heaters into our ponds because the lethal temperature for tilapia is about 50 degrees. And we were starting to lose a few of them. And if any type of stress, they would die really quickly. So. But that they were in for 1 week, and so. But okay.
Did you add any water? Was this very much? It wasn't a circulating system.
Not a circulating system, no. Another shot of the solar ponds. Okay. This is what I was supposed to be talking about the whole time is aquaculture, but I'm afraid I would really run on if I got into it. So I'm going to just try and be really brief, and describe a little bit about the. Solar ponds and how they're used in food production, and hope that people don't think that aquaculture is limited to these closed systems. There's a big wide area in open system culture, similar to like what we're going to be doing here with the trout. I suppose we are planning to get 4,000 rainbow trout in about a week and a half, and stock again in the plunge this year, and try some more experiments. But the work. And there is some work going on at New Alchemy along these lines, too. I was specifically involved with a grant from the National Science Foundation, which we received to do some real heavy-duty experimentation on these solar ponds and try and find what the maximum production would be, minimum labor inputs, and we're having computer monitoring of levels of oxygen and pH and temperature. And periodic checks of different levels of a lot of different nutrients. But anyway, okay, the principle of a solar algae pond, you bring the pond up out of the ground and allow light penetration not only at the surface but also in the sides. And you can see a dense bloom of algae is the result, if there are any nutrients in the water at all. And then the culture of fish, we tried to culture a variety of species, because polyculture techniques, culture of more than one species, allows maximum production. It's been proven a number of times, rather than culture of just one species. The tilapia is a fantastic fish for these type of systems, because it eats very low on the food chain. It filters algae out of the water through its gills, has very fine gills, and then can feed on this. And then we put in with the tilapia also catfish, bullheads, different species of Israeli carp, all of which are good food fish, and they feed on different levels of the food chain, and you get good production. I can't say exactly what the maximum production would be for this type of system. That's the kind of experiments that we're running right now, trying to find the optimum production would be, but trying to minimize investment and labor. And these are not flowing systems, they're closed systems, so there is a problem with waste buildup, and trying to find biological solutions to these type of problems that result when you have a dense population of fish and you're trying to get good growth.
Is that a fiberglass tank?
That's the same fiberglass as used in the ark, with a 90% transmittance of light. It's also a thermal pane. There are two layers of it, so the light goes in easily and the heat doesn't escape very easily. These ponds, it would be less than 10 degrees outside, and the ponds sometimes got up to 80 degrees. Mm. It was just incredible.
Is that thermal pane also in that first building you were talking about? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that whole building is double layer.
How tall is that?
That's 5 feet tall, 5 feet in diameter. Mm. I should have a person in there, I guess, too. Okay. I think now I just threw in a few more slides. That's, I believe, about all I was going to say.
Solar ponds are outside.
Oh, well.
The ones inside help heat the building.
Right. And these ones outside, they're for different species of fish. We had, I might mention that these ponds didn't freeze. I was living in Woods Hole, about a half a block from the ocean, which froze out as far as you could see, and these ponds did not freeze this last winter.
The ocean froze?
The ocean froze. Yeah. You don't hear about it too often, but it did. And we were growing outside. We had catfish, bullheads, carp all winter long. Inside we had the tilapia.
And it's just the light and the algae that keeps the water going?
Yeah, right. Well, there's a reflecting wall in the back, as you can see, and there's the white marble chips on the ground. So, and this, I had the best suntan in the Cape. Let me tell you, I've been working out with them all spring. It was just incredible. The light in that solar courtyard is intense.
Is the top also covered with the same?
Right, and we take those tops off in the summer, because, and then allows the heat to escape.
Well, the top is covered in the winter.
In the winter, right.
Do they have enough oxygen?
Well, the algae produce oxygen.
Oh.
The algae produce oxygen. We did have, not in the outside ponds, in the inside ponds we had aeration during the night, run by the little... Well, actually, the windmill wasn't running it this last winter. It was still getting hooked up. But the algae produce oxygen during the day, getting very supersaturated levels of oxygen, and then the fish consume the oxygen during the night. Didn't have very many mortalities. Didn't have very dense stockings either. This was really the first winter for these outside ponds, and so.
Are these specially built tanks that you have?
Mm-hmm. These are, I think they are now commercially available, and they'll also be fairly easy to construct yourself. You can buy a 5 foot wide sheet of Kelwell fiberglass and build one. I think the cost would be about $60 for building one yourself, and perhaps about $150 if you bought it ready-made.
This is a double layer.
This is double layer, and it's also on a little styrofoam pad on the bottom there. That's one interesting thing. At the Ark in Prince Edward Island in Canada, it's not only a solar greenhouse. I think I'm talking too long. But it's also housed living quarters for a family of four, has a laboratory inside, workshop, and fish ponds and agriculture. And they have two sets of solar ponds, one with insulation on the bottom where they were growing tilapia, one with no insulation where they were growing trout.